content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I'll read an article from the January 19, 2026 issue of the New Yorker, The Backcountry Rescue Squad at America's Busiest National Park. In the Great Smoky Mountains, an auxiliary team of elite outdoorsmen answers the call when park goers' hikes, climbs, and rafting adventures go wrong. By Paige Williams. America's busiest national park isn't Yosemite or Yellowstone. It's the Great Smoky Mountains, which straddles the heavily forested border of North Carolina and Tennessee. Half the country can drive there in a day. The park measures 522,427 acres, nearly the size of Rhode Island. The terrain is choked with rhododendron and dog hobble, ground cover that makes it easy to get lost and hard to be found. There are 848 miles of trail and countless manways, which masquerade as trails. The many waterfalls are fed by rain on par with that of the Pacific Northwest. The rivers rise and boil with astonishing speed. There is little to no cell service. Every year, the park logs more than 12 million visits, some of which go poorly. From the annals of misadventure and bad luck, a 15-year-old boy jumped between rocks at a scenic overlook and fell 500 feet. Lightning struck near where a man lay reading in his tent. The charge welded him to the ground for at least 10 seconds. A cyclist hit a deer and flew over the handlebars. 175 feet deep in a cave, two spelunkers ran out of rope. A child got separated from his family and wound up at the base of a cliff. Hikers discovered a man freezing on the Appalachian Trail, 74 miles of which passed through the park. He didn't have a coat and wrapped his feet in underwear and duct tape. A fisherman was stung more than 100 times by yellow jackets. Three stranded backpackers, unable to figure out how to build a proper fire, even with a small blowtorch, burned their clothes. A kid tried to cross a flooding river after his friends warned him not to and was swept downstream. An inner tuber fell into a river and got trapped between submerged rocks. "The river will take you," John Charbel, a veteran whitewater rafter, told me the other day. His friends call him Sharbs. He had just texted me a video of himself on Class 5 Rapids, where, bloop, he popped right out of his boat. In the national parks, drowning ranks behind only motor vehicle crashes as the leading cause of accidental death. Sharbs' rafting drama ended with him dragging himself onto a riverbank and bushwhacking his way back to camp, where one of his buddies, Big Bill, unaware of the bloop, asked, "Why are you so dirty?" Sharbs, who is in his early 40s, grew up in Knoxville, 36 miles north of the park, and has been a Smokies regular since elementary school. In the early 2000s, he and his wife, Laura, a veterinarian, worked on cattle ranches in California. When we would do roundups, there was this old firefighter who'd come out and help us, and I'd talk to him and think, "That sounds like a pretty cool lifestyle," he said. Firefighting didn't stick. Sharbs joined the Tennessee Army National Guard. In 2012, he deployed to Afghanistan and spent a year in Helmand Province as a combat medic. He was telling me about it over sandwiches in the park, at a picnic table beside the little river, when an acorn the size of a golf ball very nearly fell on my head. Sharbs went, "Holy S-word." Then he said, "Also a big killer in the park? Falling tree branches. Dead, dangling limbs are called widowmakers." Jonathan D., the park's medical director, who is a family physician, told me that a patient once asked him which of the park's wild animals frightened him most. He said that nothing scared him more than the wind. In the American West, visitors to national parks know to expect remoteness. The Smokies' proximity to cities creates a false sense of security. The park is headquartered in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, which has been characterized as an amusement venue posing as a town. You can step out of the forest and play laser tag or eat a corn dog. A brochure describes Gatlinburg as America's mountain paradise. In the Great Smoky Mountains, which have been called a Bermuda Triangle of volatile conditions, a hike can start at noon in tank top weather and end at night in a snowstorm. Visitors have been known to climb to a high point to watch a sunset, forgetting that they'll need light to get back down. They don't think to bring water. They misjudge distances and underestimate the landscape, which isn't just steep, it's slippery, snaky, rocky, rooty, humid, buggy, foggy, and misty. Each year in the national park, there are more than 100 backcountry emergencies. Andrew Harrington, a former park ranger, told me, "The people that get in trouble are the ones that are wearing flip-flops and shorts. They buy a $1 trail map and decide to hike and take a wrong turn. Now it's dark. They're trying to navigate with their phone. The phone's dying. The kids and the wife are screaming. Everybody's mad and crying and scared. Sometimes accidents just happen." Lodged in my brain is a photo that Harrington showed me of a woman's right leg, bare from the knee down and shaped like a hockey stick. The foot cocked 90 degrees to the left. She had snapped her ankle while hiking to Laurel Falls, which search and rescue workers have nicknamed Everybody Falls. The park recently shut down the trail for refurbishments. Park rangers respond to and manage every emergency, but they routinely need outside help to conduct rescues, especially deep in the backcountry. Harrington, like Sharbs, is a seasoned search and rescue volunteer. They, and others like them, are essential to public safety operations in the Smokies, in part because they have so much experience in that highly specific environment. One afternoon in October, I met Harrington at Look Rock, the apex of the Foothills Parkway on the western end of the park near Townsend, which calls itself the peaceful side of the Smokies. The crowds and traffic are less intense than in Gatlinburg, and the mountain views are unimpeded. Decades ago, Townsend limited development. A Ripley's peaceful sign is unimaginable. Harrington and I left our vehicles in a deserted parking lot and followed a manway through a band of trees, stepping over roots the size of boa constrictors. At the dizzying edge of a sandstone cliff, he spread a park map on a boulder and ran a hand across it. "It's hard to grasp the immensity," he said. "A particularly remote pocket, Tri-Corner Knob, has a reputation for being one of the nation's true wilderness areas." When I asked Harrington to describe the park's personality, he said, "The park is just neutral. People are like Mother Nature's out to kill you or Mother Nature's out to help you. It doesn't care. It just does its thing." Harrington had turned 50 the previous day. He has a reddish-gray beard and bright blue eyes and shaves his head. He talks fast and drinks not much alcohol and no coffee. He is twice divorced with an 11-year-old son and an 8-year-old daughter. He lives just outside the park in a house that he built on a mountainside with a catfish lake at the foot of his driveway and a yard full of chickens, which he keeps mainly for the eggs. To get there, you drive an infamous 11-mile section of two-lane highway called the Dragon's Tail, which has 318 curves. When I visited in November, photographers had stationed themselves at pull-offs to shoot pictures of motorcycle daredevils and a nose-to-bumper caravan of candy-colored Corvettes. Harrington told me, "If my kids ever want a motorcycle, I'll tell them, first you're going to go to work the Dragon's Tail for a year with the Blount County Rescue Squad. Pick up all the pieces and see what that's like." Harrington grew up in Australia, where his mother is from, and south of Nashville in the rural town of Thompson Station, the site of a Civil War battle. More than anything, he liked being outdoors. "I thought survival was making arrowheads and wearing a loincloth around the woods, going barefoot," he told me. In 1993, the day before he turned 18, Harrington was sport climbing in a state park near Chattanooga when a rock fell about 60 feet and broke his skull. He wasn't wearing a helmet. His friends saw him collapse unconscious. One of them, a cross-country runner, sprinted for help. Rescue was delayed because a responding park ranger had a heart attack during the hike in. Harrington's injury, a depression fracture, temporarily paralyzed much of the left side of his body and derailed his goal of becoming an Army Ranger. Instead, he studied wildlife biology at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville. He entered what he called his bushcraft phase. I wore all wool clothes, carried a big axe, he said. He traveled to Canada to study with survival instructors, and he read a lot. Books like The Forager's Harvest, The Outdoor Survival Handbook, 6 Ways In and 12 Ways Out. He told me, when I get into something, I get really into it. In 1998, Harrington heard an interview on NPR with Rick Varner, who hunted feral hogs for the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. Varner described the creatures as diabolically cunning, destructive, and nocturnal. He would hike 10 or 12 miles at night, hunting, and spend daylight hours in camp reading. Some weeks it rained every day. A lot of the time his knees hurt. He would assemble and bait chain link traps, which had been dropped by helicopter. The policy was to shoot and bury your catch. Critics complained about squandered meat, but Varner told NPR, nothing goes to waste in the wild. He considered it payback when bears came across that chunk of protein. Feral hogs are an invasive species. To Harrington, Varner's life sounded like a boy's dream. He volunteered in the Smokies hog hunting program and called Varner Rambo Ricky. Soon he got hired and asked to be assigned to the 20-mile district, a remote posting near the Dragon's Tail. Long stretches of solitude neither bothered him nor appeared to impair his sociability. Harrington is more gregarious and diplomatic, though perhaps not less introspective, than what you might expect from someone who spent so much time alone in the woods. One day, he told me, men typically have either a trust issue or an unworthiness thing. If it's that unworthiness thing, you start to seek external validation through achievement, adventure, women, all that type of stuff. In 2008, Harrington became a Smokies law enforcement ranger, energized by the thought of hunting poachers of ginseng and game. He often put his hand up for search and rescue missions and realized that he wanted to be involved in search and rescue work for the rest of his life after he and Rambo Ricky found a pair of lost grandparents by blowing whistles, a low-tech piece of life-saving gear. As the grandparents reunited with their family, Harrington had to step away and compose himself. The Park Service closed 20 Miles Station. Harrington couldn't think of anything worse than being posted to Gatlinburg or saddled with sneaking around campgrounds looking for dope smokers, babysitting tubers, or typing report after report. While listening to a podcast called Peace Revolution, he decided that staying on for the next 25 years was not worth a future pension of $1,200 a month. In 2013, he resigned, giving his written reason as new chapter of life. You sure? His boss asked. Until recently, a job with the federal government was one of the most stable in the United States. Harrington was sure. A month later, he filed incorporation papers for a new company, Big Pig Outdoors, and became a wilderness educator. The survivalism and bushcraft industry is expected to surpass $3 billion by 2034. Harrington had no plans to turn Big Pig into an elaborate survival school. He just wanted to live an outdoors life, provide for his family, and help others reconnect to what we, as humans, already instinctively know how to do. Using his own near-death experience as an example, he stressed preparation and critical thinking over the kind of primitive skills that were hyped, dangerously, he thought, on reality television. In a life-threatening situation, nobody lost in the woods needed to be trying to make a bow and arrow. What that person did need to know was how to keep the body's core temperature up and how to build a fire in really bad weather. The one item that Harrington would want with him during a backcountry emergency is not a big knife, it's a sleeping bag. He told me about a lost hiker who'd survived by simply laying in his sleeping bag for 4 days. A case that haunts him and others concerned a woman who got turned around in the Smokies while walking back to her car. She did what no one should do when lost. She kept walking. The search lasted for days and involved nearly 200 people. Sharbs found the woman lying face up in shallow water, dead from hypothermia, wearing only leggings. Hypothermia can trick the body into thinking it's burning up and cause a victim to strip, a sign of imminent death known as paradoxical undressing. If she had stayed put, rescuers might have reached her in time. A simple trash bag, another low-tech piece of life-saving gear, could have preserved her body heat. Poke three holes in it and wear it like a poncho. Harrington likes to say, if you can treat your injury and stay warm and hydrated, you've got a pretty good chance to make it out. At Big Pig, Harrington's students range from middle schoolers to game wardens. He taught land navigation, wilderness first aid, foraging. He customized courses for women's groups, companies, and families, and trained prospective contestants of the Discovery Channel show Naked and Afraid, in which a man and a woman are stranded in a remote location without clothes, food, or water, and with one personal item each, and must work together to survive for 3 weeks. At REI, he taught a free course, Reality of Survival. On Big Pig's blog, he published roundups of global search and rescue cases, often posting hypotheticals. You slip and knock yourself out while deer hunting and wake up disoriented. Stranded by a freak snowstorm, you're running low on food after 3 days in a backcountry shelter. Now what? Harrington homesteaded. He ate daylilies, violets, greens, chickweed, shepherd's purse, greenbrier chips, sheep sorrel, thistle stalks. If a wild hog came onto his property, he killed, butchered, and ate it, then freeze-dried the leftovers. Disaster preparedness was also something that Harrington thought about a lot. He encouraged people to store food and water in case of catastrophe. A trip to Costco can get you 50 pounds of beans and 50 pounds of rice, providing 160,000-plus calories for around $75. His intention wasn't to stoke fear, but to promote self-reliance. If you trace your lineage back, he wrote, you won't have to go far to find members of your family that were living more independently than we do nowadays. Harrington was 2 years into his new chapter of life when he started missing search and rescue work. He approached his former boss, Steve Kloster, the Smokies' chief ranger at the time, with a proposal to support the national park by creating an independent all-hazards emergency response team of elite outdoors athletes who were willing to step away from their jobs and families in, say, the middle of the night or on a holiday, and in weather that you wouldn't let your dog out in, to save the life of a stranger. They would train for the gnarliest missions, swift water rescue, long-distance carryouts, winter rescue, and technical rescue, which involves complex systems of ropes, pulleys, and carabiners. Harrington wanted to name the team BUSAR for Backcountry Unit Search and Rescue. Kloster liked the idea. He asked Harrington how he planned to keep his guys motivated. Harrington told him, leave that to me. In the U.S., search and rescue missions overwhelmingly rely on volunteers, Chris Boyer, the executive director of the National Association for Search and Rescue, told me. It's the local Safeway butcher. It's the lawyer, the teacher. Harrington's first recruit was one of his survival class students, Matt Jernigan, a Knoxville native and a hardcore mountain biker who worked a high-paying job in software product management, but had only ever wanted to be a park ranger. Jernigan had hiked all 150 trails in the Smokies. The moment Harrington mentioned BUSAR, Jernigan said, I'm in. He's the team's president. Other members came by word of mouth and occasionally by happenstance. Dee, the family physician, had no formal connection to the park, though he and his wife, Whitney, a pediatrician, avidly hiked there with their four children. The Dees live in Maryville, which, like Gatlinburg, is one of the park's gateway communities. One day in 2019, Dee, who's in his mid-40s, was on Facebook and clicked on an image of a waterfall, which took him to BUSAR's page, a recruitment poster whose language Harrington had borrowed from an apocryphal Ernest Shackleton ad, read, experienced outdoor athletes wanted for hazardous work. No wages, long hours, adverse weather, high level of fitness required. The team worked out together every Tuesday evening near Dee's home. A photo showed a couple dozen men and women in matching neon yellow gear standing resolutely on a mountaintop. "Something inside me kind of leapt," he told me. Dee had no spare time. But after 3 days of being unable to stop thinking about rescuing people in the woods, he emailed the address on the Facebook account, writing, "I don't know anything about search and rescue, but the idea of crawling through the mountains, rescuing people, really appeals to me." Harrington invited Dee out to eat with some of the team, and when that went well, he invited him to a workout. Harrington and his teammates designed their workouts to be brutal. Every Boosar I've met has confessed to craving what one called purposeful shared suffering. A team member would concoct an exercise. The rest would do it. The exercises mimicked the demands of difficult backcountry missions. Someone who could walk up and over a picnic table for 30 minutes wearing a 20-pound pack with a 50-pound sandbag slung over his shoulder would likely be able to help tote a rescue litter, even if, as once happened, the patient weighed 400 pounds. The fittest park rangers could do that, too. There simply weren't enough of them. A tricky rescue may warrant dozens of people, possibly more than are on duty and available at any given time. The Park Service required that a ranger assigned to arduous duty be able to walk 3 miles on flat ground carrying a 45-pound pack in less than 45 minutes. The arduous pack test was how Boosars warmed up. Harrington told me, "In 10 minutes, I can gauge whether a candidate has the mental and physical fortitude to do this job." There's a certain personality that appeals to. Most of Dee's strength was in his lower body. He's an ardent road cyclist. He had no trouble passing the pack hike or the picnic table exercise, or, as Boosar's fitness test also required, completing at least 15 225-pound deadlifts within a minute. Then came the burpee pull-ups. A burpee pull-up entails lying belly flat, popping straight up and into a pull-up, chin above the bar, please, and then dropping back to the belly in one fluid motion. The exercise works all the major muscles. The Boosar test called for 50 burpee pull-ups within 10 minutes while wearing a 20-pound pack. Dee failed. He went home devastated. His wife told him, "Johnny, I'm just going to say it. You need to train and do what it takes to pass this test, because I've never seen anything light you up like this has." Dee trained for months. When his family vacationed in the backcountry of Alaska, he took rubber resistance bands. "We're in the middle of nowhere, and I'm wrapping them around trees," he told me. He passed the second tryout and became a Boosar. "I started from absolute zero and just ate it up," he said. He developed such an aptitude for technical rescue that he now teaches the subject for the national parks. Last spring, when the Smokies' longtime medical director retired, the park asked Dee, who by then was Boosar's vice president, to replace him. He agreed on the condition that during search and rescue missions, he be considered one of the grunts. Working search and rescue reminded him of the decision that he and his wife made to become foster parents, and then adoptive parents, after they had had two biological children of their own. It felt like the right thing to do. The world's first national park, Yellowstone, was established in 1872 in what were then the territories of Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho. The writer and conservationist Wallace Stegner later called reserving the country's signature landscapes for public enjoyment the best idea we ever had. There are now 63 national parks and hundreds of park units, monuments, historic battlefields, scenic roadways, seashores, all run by the National Park Service, under the Department of the Interior. Funding and staffing are not keeping pace with the popularity of the parks, which hit a record 332 million recreational visits in 2024. By the end of that year, there was a $23 billion maintenance backlog. Then, in 2025, the Park Service lost 24% of its permanent staff. At least 1,000 positions were slashed by the Department of Government Efficiency. This isn't becoming more efficient, Phil Francis, who for 8 years served as the Smokies' deputy superintendent and for 3 as acting superintendent, told me. The staff can't do as much as they once did because there's just not as many of them. He described what is happening to the national parks as death by 1,000 cuts. The most recent shutdown of the federal government was also the longest, October 1st to November 12th. President Donald Trump insisted that the national parks remain open, at least skeletally. The National Parks Conservation Association declared that the administration considerably exacerbated the Park Service's resource crisis by pushing remaining staff to their limits. The looming threat of a full shutdown hit the Smokies just in time for leaf peeping season and fall break, a particularly busy period that helps local businesses survive through the winter. Tourists spend $2.2 billion annually in the area, making the Smokies, according to Forbes magazine, the most economically valuable of the national parks. A consortium that included Sevier County, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, and a prominent nonprofit, Friends of the Smokies, stepped in and kept the park running. The Smokies, which was established in 1934, has never imposed an entrance fee. But in 2023, it started charging for parking, $5 a day, $40 for the year. The fee generates $5 million annually. Some of the proceeds were used to create a preventative search and rescue team, or PSAR, which has 7 full-time positions. These rangers educate visitors about avoidable behaviors that may, in turn, trigger a search and rescue mission, which can be risky and expensive. Between 2019 and 2023, the Park Service spent $22 million on search and rescue. Rescuees aren't asked to pay anything, even when carelessness or ignorance caused the problem. I spent the better part of one autumn day watching Joshua Albritton, the Smokies' PSAR chief, genially engage with dozens of hikers on Alum Cave Trail, a popular 5.5-mile route that leads to a backcountry lodge. He asked if they had enough water, how far they planned to walk. Just above a steep, winding staircase at Arch Rock, a picturesque landmark about 1.5 miles in, he told a family with small children, "The terrain gets a lot more difficult at this point, just for your information." When the park needs rescue help, it issues a call-out to a local emergency services network, which includes BUSAR, whose members receive mission requests in a signal chat that Harrington set up. More than half of the search and rescue workers who show up for the most trying missions are BUSARs. Currently, there are 19 of them, all men. Harrington leads the recruiting and encourages nicknames. Big Bill is Bill Ivey, a Smokies wildlife ranger and a Marine reservist who is 6'6". Jernigan is Jernigator, who, this year at age 55, left his software career to become a wilderness EMT and a park ranger, the life he had wanted all along. Captain Morgan is Andrew Morgan, a physician's assistant and a former member of the Army Special Forces. Superman is Ken Miller, a retired surgeon who serves with 9 local, state, and federal search and rescue organizations, but, so goes a joke, assures his wife that he belongs to only one. Several years ago, when Miller turned 80, the guys were so excited about throwing him a surprise party that they forgot to invite him. Lando, Ben Lancomer, grew up in Montana and trains canines. Silkwood, Mark Silkwood, is also ex-Special Forces and an Army contractor. Cody Watson, Bursar's quartermaster, recently retired early from the Air National Guard. He's an EMT, as is John Danner. Zach Copeland, who chairs BUSAR's board, is a former wildlife biologist turned poultry farmer. Howitzer, Andrew Howe, is a civil engineer and a competitive mountain biker. Kelly Street is a Knoxville lawyer and a former military intelligence officer. Caleb Edmiston is a chiropractor who, like Harrington, has competed in mixed martial arts. Greg Greico played football at the University of Tennessee and now runs a nonprofit that rescues bear cubs. Obi Wad Jeff Wadley, a pastor, an author, and a former Civil Air Patrol officer who's been working search and rescue missions in the Smokies for more than 45 years, teaches courses on lost person behavior, and may be the greatest living expert on airplane crashes in the park. Daz, Andrew Randazzo, started a company that provides continuing education for medical industry professionals. He did emergency response work in New York City during the COVID-19 outbreak and near the border of Syria and Turkey after the earthquakes in 2023. Ski is Brian Borkowski, who flies Black Hawk helicopters for the Tennessee Army National Guard. Sharbs is a critical care flight medic for the Guard. He's often the guy at the end of Ski's rescue cable. Bursar's unofficial motto, right foot, derives from RTFOOT, an acronym inspired by a response that Sharps once gave when a teammate asked how a mission had turned out, rescued the F word out of them. Every prospective member of Bursar must pass Harrington's winter survival class. The final exam requires students to build a fire in the woods after having been submerged in a frigid creek. Bursars have been known to retake the course for fun. The Smokies, like other national parks, pay some outside search and rescue forces an hourly wage, ranging from about $25 to $33. But a third of Bursars take no pay at all, and the income is so negligible that Harrington doesn't mention it when he recruits. "Here's the thing," he told me. "My guys don't have to be there. They're here because they want to be." Bursars also roll for a child or for someone with dementia. Most members have a spouse or kids at home. Big Bill's wife, Jenny Ivy, a professor of equine nutrition and exercise physiology at the University of Tennessee, told me that her husband got involved in Bursar when their children were little. It was like, "What do you mean you need to go out again? It's a volunteer thing." But it was really meaningful for Bill to find that community and to know that you're giving back. "If our kids were hurt, I'd want somebody to go." One Sunday in August of 2019, J.R. Huber, who worked in the residential mortgage industry in Knoxville, took his twin daughters, Peyton and Lauren, for a short hike in the Smokies. The girls were 14. They chose a moderate trail to Fern Branch Falls, 4 miles round trip. Huber wanted a quick in and out so that he could get home in time to play a soccer match. They carried water, but little else. Peyton, a promising soccer player who was starting her freshman year of high school, ran up ahead to take a selfie at the top of the waterfall. Her dad had just opened his mouth to warn her to be careful when she slipped. "I could see her reach for..." "There was nothing to reach for," he told me. "The vision that will not ever leave my mind is my daughter in the air falling." Peyton landed about 20 feet below on a narrow rock ledge. Huber clawed through the underbrush to reach her. She was bleeding from a gash in her head, but she was conscious. She told her dad, "I'm sorry." And he told her, "You're alive." Her left wrist was broken. Her left femur had snapped. The femur is the human body's longest, strongest bone, and among the most agonizing to break. Peyton kept saying, "I want to die." Huber sent Lauren up the mountain to try for a cell phone signal. He knew that he had to get Peyton away from the water to keep her dry and warm. Even in temperate conditions, trauma can cause hypothermia. Organs shut down as the body loses heat. Think of a person walking through a house turning off the lights. "I'm going to have to carry you," Huber told Peyton. When he picked her up by the armpits, like Simba in The Lion King, she told me, she could see the grotesque deformity of her leg, which was dangling. Huber carried Peyton off the ledge and into the woods, about 10 feet away. He used some of their drinking water to clean her head wound. But beyond that, there wasn't much that he could do but hold her head in his lap, tell her to take deep breaths, and play Kenny Chesney songs on his phone. Lauren came back. She'd been able to call 911. "They're on their way, but it's going to be forever," she told her dad and sister. "They have to assemble a team." Every search and rescue mission begins with an investigation. Who needs help and why? Where are they? or where were they last seen? How old are they? What kind of physical shape are they in? What are they carrying? The incident commander, always a park ranger, may order a hasty, in which a scout or two gets on scene, assesses the situation, and radios out details that will help determine the size and nature of the response. Sharbs did the hasty for Peyton. He crawled through stinging nettles to where she lay beside a log. When he saw the waterfall, he considered her lucky for having landed where she did. If she had missed the ledge, she would have been deader than Dillinger, he told me. He zipped Peyton into an emergency blanket and started an IV. He was authorized by radio to administer the maximum amount of painkillers for her size and age. Huber told me it was still never enough. There's a saying in search and rescue, rescue is not imminent. Park staff and outside search and rescue workers may be busy on other calls, or they may have to drive all the way around or through the park just to reach the staging area and start hiking in. Peyton's team eventually arrived with a Stokes basket, a lipped titanium litter that has netting and straps to secure a body during difficult transport. They wore helmets and carried ropes and harnesses, and their waistbands were racked with carabiners and gloves. The team decided that the best way out was down the front of the waterfall. Huber watched them unfurl ropes and design rigging, later describing the system to me as this contraption that they created on the fly. Tech rescue, in fact, requires considerable and consistent practice. I recently spent a day watching one such practice at Newfound Gap, a scenic overlook where President Franklin D. Roosevelt formally dedicated the Smokies in September 1940. 24 rangers, hussars, and park volunteers situated themselves on a service road flanked by a steep wooded slope above and another below. At the direction of Albritton, the hussar chief, the teams mountain goated up and down the pitches, which were slick with autumn leaves. They brushed up on the alpine butterfly knot, the prusik, the figure eight, the distal hitch. In one drill, several team members stood 40 yards upslope pulling as others below guided and balanced a silicone dummy in a litter. Ready to haul, the person at the bottom would yell. Someone positioned roughly mid-slope would repeat, ready to haul. At one point, Albritton announced a hypothetical, a broken femur. The team fitted a dummy with a traction splint. Ethan Schwartz, a park ranger and an EMT, who had been telling us about having lived in a South American rainforest where he adopted a howler monkey named Paula, explained to newer members, we're preventing increasing muscle contractions and spasms that would cause the sharp, severed bone to puncture the femoral artery. A patient can bleed to death without the bone ever breaking the skin. A traction splint can ease the pain. This proved untrue for Peyton. As the team lowered her down the waterfall, buckled into her litter, the basket unavoidably bumping the rock wall, she screamed repeatedly at Sharbs, I hate you, John! Which even her horrified father had to admit was kind of funny. Sharbs later told me, I was like, yeah, I get it. I'm causing you a lot of pain right now. But we're also saving your life, so suck it up, Buttercup. It got dark. Peyton's rescuers turned on their headlamps. They mounted her litter on a large treaded wheel and, where they could, rolled her through the forest, which resounded with crickets and frogs. They inched her across a rushing creek, on a log bridge barely as wide as the litter, and, ultimately, to a waiting ambulance, which took her to a medevac chopper. Peyton had been asking if she would be able to go to soccer practice on Monday. No, honey. Sharbs told her. She missed her freshman year of play, but started as a goalie for her remaining 3 years of high school, setting Tennessee state record for shutouts. She now starts for Liberty University. In 2025, she was named her conference's goalkeeper of the year. When I called her family in November, Peyton's team had just won the conference championship and was en route to the NCAA tournament. That wasn't the only waterfall story I heard in the Smokies. Watson, Bussard's quartermaster, had recently discovered that he was neighbors with Natty Gray, who, in July 2020 took his then-wife and some friends into the park to Spruce Flats Falls, a multi-part cascade with a shallow pool 35 miles west of where Peyton went down. Barefoot and wearing only swim trunks, Gray climbed to the fourth level and then went higher, looking for a fifth. He fell and landed 45 feet below, on his back, on a log. A friend who witnessed this thought, he's dead. Gray spent so much time in the backcountry alone that he carried a personal SOS beacon. But the beacon was in his backpack, which he had left at the bottom of the falls. He later recalled negotiating with himself about when to become conscious. One half of his brain would say to the other, "Are you ready?" And the other half would answer, "No." "At the moment I said yes, all of the pain and the noise and the sight flooded in," he told me. He was able to tell his wife how to activate the SOS beacon. Two Bussars, Jernigan and Lando, arrived with a park ranger, followed by Harrington and several others. Somehow, Gray had wound up in the water. His veins had contracted to the point that the ranger, who was a paramedic, couldn't place an IV for painkillers. A needle had to be jammed directly into Gray's shin. I'd been trying to meet up with Gray when Harrington, Jernigan, and I happened to run into him one night at Peaceful Side Social, a restaurant in Townsend. Gray and a friend and their husky mixes were finishing dinner at a picnic table. "Last time I saw you, I was the guy that had the plastic over you," Harrington told him. "We made a little plastic tent to keep you warm because you were getting hypothermic." "I was in the river for 3 hours," Gray said. Gray, who was in his early 60s with silver hair and a perpetual tan, grew up in Nashville. He changed his name from Scott to Naughty after spending time in India, where he travels for work. He described himself to us as an experienced outdoorsman and said that whenever he went ice kayaking, he'd make himself swim to remind his brain that his body could handle the cold. "You probably don't remember, but I was setting up a rope system," Harrington told him. "I do remember, and I was terrified," Gray said. He had fallen in what he called a deep slot in the earth. The search and rescue team planned to raise him up enough that he could be carried out via manway. "I was terrified because, have you ever broken a rib?" Gray asked us. He had broken 7. "This arm completely tore away from my clavicle and shoulder. I had bleeding in my lungs. My pelvis wasn't broken, but it really was not happy. Burst eardrum, sprained wrist." The Tennessee Army National Guard ended up sending a Black Hawk and dropping a long hoist cable. Gray remembered a flight medic standing over him like a stormtrooper. The day after we saw Gray, I visited him at home. He was living in a campground on the Peaceful Side in an elegantly outfitted Airstream next to a well-organized trailer stocked with outdoors gear. The Airstream had a Kamala Harris decal on the back. This had cost Gray a couple of friendships in the campground. He didn't mind. Over coffee, he told me about his YouTube channel, where he pairs meditations and poems that he's written with footage shot in national parks, and he showed me his collection of first edition books by John Muir, and some of the tchotchkes that he'd brought home from his travels, rocks, river glass, a tiny Buddha. I tell people, every year you should find yourself in a place where you are completely naked in the wild. The first time you do it, be somewhere where there's no chance anybody will see you. You will discover how completely out of your element you are, he said. When I go out into the wild by myself, it's not because I want to be naked, it's because I want to know who I am. It worried Gray that digitalization was creating an alternative reality. He went on, and people rely on it. If it ever breaks, the true crisis of society will be people not having any capability to cope. We have to accept that it's going to be non-governmental approaches that solve problems. Bussar is a perfect example. Most people don't know about the cuts to the parks because, on the surface, the Interior Secretary has said, "Keep the window dressing, everybody. Keep the buses and trains running." Yet, they're cutting the biologists and the rangers. People that maintain trails in the backcountry are unheralded. They go out with chainsaws and on horseback and clear trees and repair trails. If you don't have that, what happens within a generation is that the park falls apart. At busy times, Busar pre-deploys, which means hanging out in the Smokies in case something happens. Busar and the park have been talking about pre-deploying more. The logistics would need to be worked out. Busar is a nonprofit with no full-time staff. Park rangers drive automobiles from the federal fleet. Busars show up in their own vehicles. Harrington has a 2009 Honda Pilot with 249,000 miles on it, a crack running across the windshield, and shredded armrests. Busars buy their own gas and stock much of their own equipment. They need new emergency radios. They have no headquarters. Their skills must be continually practiced and recertified, which costs money. The organization relies on donations and grants, but the most it ever collected in a single year was $56,000 in 2022. Busars would rather hike all night in a blizzard than fundraise or do administration. One Saturday in mid-November, Team Busar convened in the woods in Tallahassee, Tennessee, just outside the park, on the peaceful side, for quarterly training. A friend of Harrington's lets him use private land for that and for Big Pig's classes. Training lasts all day, and afterward, anyone who wants to camp spends the night. It was just after 9 in the morning when I got there and parked on a dead-end dirt road behind Busar's equipment trailer. To the right, flat ground fronted a creek. To the left, rose steep woodland. 20 yards up a visible manway stood a semi-open teepee structure cloaked by a salvaged parachute. There was seating around a fire pit. Several Busars had already set up tents. Sharbs brought a one-person cot pod. My tent got pitched near the creek. At the other end of camp loomed a gigantic khaki military tent, which Watson and Harrington had erected the previous day so that the team's children could bunk together. Harrington collectively calls them Cobra Kids. The cobra is a Busar symbol. The kids ranged in age from 4 to 12. The military tent was soon being referred to as the Thunderdome, so constant was the ruckus. Around mid-afternoon, after researchers on tech rescue, land navigation, and tracking, the Busars loaded into vehicles and were driven a couple of miles away. They were dropped off with instructions to hike, in pairs, to predetermined coordinates in the forest, where they would find Harrington playing the part of a school teacher who had fallen ill while leading an elementary school field trip. Harrington and 8 kids and I walked to the designated point to wait. He told the children not to be alarmed when he started acting out of it. As the first pair of yellow helmets appeared in the forest, Captain Morgan and Kelly Street, Harrington curled into the fetal position and went silent, shivering. Cap knelt beside him and checked his vital signs. Street asked the kids the patient's name, and the kids, giggling, said, "Mrs. Harrington." Cap pulled a Busar beanie from his pack and put it on Harrington's head. Street took out an emergency blanket, and he and Cap wrapped Harrington in it, insulating him from the cold ground. Street turned and said, "All right, kids, can y'all help me collect some dry sticks?" Sharbs and Lando arrived, with Lando's working canine, Cato, a German shepherd who wore a Busar harness and yellow-rimmed goggles. Street, kneeling 2 feet away from Harrington's calves, constructed a small cone of twigs. As he worked, he kept up the act with the kids. "Where are you from?" And they replied, "Busar Academy." Street built the fire the way Harrington had taught everyone, using tinder, fat wood, and Vaseline-soaked cotton balls, hit with a spark from a ferro rod. Jernigan and Daz arrived. They strung a tarp on paracord at an angle between trees, sheltering Harrington and the fire. Watson played dispatcher. "Busar 1, 700. 700, this is Busar 1, Cap said. "Sit, Rep. We have a 50-year-old female, presently hypothermic. Location?" Sharbs read off their coordinates, which he'd written in a field notebook. "Shelter in place overnight," dispatch instructed. Within minutes, makeshift structures mushroomed in the woods. The sun was setting. The kids were getting punchy. As Watson casually quizzed them about hypothermia, One mentioned an insect that climbs up your pants and bites your balls. Watson, suppressing a laugh, said, "Stop it. Watch your mouth." Harrington came out of character and lay flat on his back with both hands behind his head, as if at home on the sofa watching a football game. He looked so cozy next to the fire that the kids clamored to get under the shelter with them. Then he jumped up, assessed the bursar's shelters one by one, and said, "All right, break it down." As Street dismantled his setup, I asked him why he had joined Bursar. He told me that he had served in the Army from 1995 to 2005, then got out, got married, went to law school, had kids. What I realized as I got into my 40s was that I wasn't done serving, he said. So this scratches that itch. It's really low on BS, and I enjoy being a part of something that's useful. Glancing at his teammates, he said, "I'm surrounded by people who are useful." Then he showed Miller and me the logger's knot that his granddaddy had taught him in childhood. Half the team stayed to camp. We made a fire at the teepee, drank beer, and stayed up late. Lando described the quarterly trainings and campouts as Bursar's sinew. They were still processing their most harrowing rescue in recent memory, which began on September 27, 2024, the day that Hurricane Helene reached the Smokies. An SOS beacon from a personal device pinged 911, alerting Rangers to a crisis at Tri-Corner Knob, where a diabetic hiker was gravely sick and deteriorating. Hiking to Tri-Corner takes at least 4 hours in good weather. As in much of the park, all-terrain vehicles are of no use because the trails are so rugged and narrow. Choppers couldn't penetrate the cloud cover. The trail was a river. The Tri-Corner mission lasted 36 hours and required dozens of people. Everybody was smoked, Big Bill told me. When he got home, he fell asleep eating a burrito. In search and rescue, a mission may require a body bag. Corpse recovery is part of the job. The Tri-Corner hiker survived. He reached out to the park to say thanks. Search and rescue workers rarely hear from the people they save, or even learn whether they ultimately survive, or how their lives turn out. I did hear about a guy who got rescued in 1974 and whose mother took a poinsettia to park headquarters every Christmas thereafter until she died in 2020. Now the son delivers the poinsettia. During the campfire portion of Bursar's quarterly training, Harrington sometimes asks his teammates to throw written questions into a hat. Everyone is expected to answer. Tell us about your craziest rescue. Tell us your worst memory from childhood. Copeland once said that Bursars tend to be first responders, military, and former athletes with a smattering of childhood trauma. Harrington told me that members join for whatever reason, but they all stay for the brotherhood. When one member deployed to Kosovo, the others mowed his family's grass. When Harrington was juggling a divorce, a sick parent, and a busted transmission, the team pooled money to help him pay legal bills. The memory still choked him up. In my dad's era, he told me, the only emotion you were allowed to express as a man was anger. The kids were up at daybreak, congregating beneath the parachute, having already swung on the rope swing, picked on one another, cried a little, and gotten into a cooler of sodas. One was eating sour cream and shredded cheddar for breakfast until a dog slurped it off her plate. Another made a rifle out of duct tape and sticks. Two had turned huge dried leaves into fairy hats. Watson cooked scrambled eggs and bacon. Daz made coffee. Lando had gone home to get Koa, his Belgian Malinois puppy whom he kept on a leash. He does bite work. The head of Sharp's cot pod had collapsed overnight, and he'd gone on sleeping, at an angle, with one hairy bare leg protruding from the zipper. When he emerged, he told us about having been attacked by a donkey and a rooster in separate incidents, which led somebody to suggest that he re-examine his relationship to nature. The group had planned to jump off a bridge and into a river. One kid said, "Good, now I'll know what hypothermia feels like." But time ran out. Watson had an ambulance shift. A couple of kids had wrestling matches. Before breaking camp, the fathers and their children lined up in a row, like a ground search team, and walked forward together, scanning for forgotten items and trash. Harrington has long admired a passage from a book called Last Child in the Woods by Richard Louv. Passion is lifted from the earth itself by the muddy hands of the young. It travels along grass-stained sleeves to the heart. He and Sharbs often talked about how cool it would be if even one Cobra Kid grew up to become a Boosar. The Smokies weren't going anywhere. The week after we left the woods, a woman who lived in one of the gateway communities was driving to her bank job when a bald eagle dropped a cat through her windshield. A 375-pound bear got stuck on the roof of Ripley's motion blaster. The bear survived. Big Bill participated in the rescue. The cat had run out of lives. As usual, I'll end with some poetry. From the January 19, 2026 issue of The New Yorker, Changing Table by Megan O'Rourke. The thing about children is they disappear. They disappear as they appear. More themselves, less yours. Here the baby is on the table, kicking his silken, pillowy legs, looking you in the eyes, squirming, farting, smiling. Their past, leaving them for good, is evermore with you. A kind of distributed emptiness fills the rooms where they used to coo and call, ma, ma, ma. Bins of plush, sticky animals, a grimy wooden stove, silence where the current of play once flowed. Now I hear traffic streaming into the future and the lost birds, the cardinal, and the mourning dove, too. We've run out of time for today's issue of The New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.